Roxy, if you could rewrite a part of your career, what would you change?
I think I would just stay less long.
I, too, might have left a certain magazine a bit earlier, but that might have also meant missing out on our friendship.
We shared a lot of meals. We stayed in tons of hotels together.
That part was fun.
So many meetings with evangelical leaders.
Did we ever get Billy Graham ruled? I guess not, because we were always like together.
I definitely did on my own and other instances in my career, but we absolutely got pastor splained to once or twice.
It's kind of a workplace hazard.
From Religion News Service, this is Saved by the City, a podcast from two Christian women dodging mansplainers, manspreaders, and man drums in New York City. I'm Roxy Stone.
And I'm Caitlin Beatty.
I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. This week on The State of Belief, Jim Wallis, founder of Sojourners and author of the new book, The False White Gospel, Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy.
It's a culmination, summation of the work that a lot of us have done for an awful long time. I think the time has come for a serious test of faith.
The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Distributed by Religion News Service Podcasts and available on your favorite podcast app. I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. The State of Belief is a weekly podcast with a potent mix of spiritual wisdom, political strategy, and hopeful commentary. In a series of inspiring conversations, celebrating our diversity, and bringing us together to, in the words of the great James Baldwin, achieve our country. The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Distributed by Religion News Service Podcasts and available on your favorite podcast app.
So say a little bit more about what that was and why you wish you would have stayed less long.
This is always so hard because it's like, in some ways, water under the bridge, and in some ways, always feels petty to just go back and like complain about an old workplace or an old boss, especially when like plenty of people here know who I'm talking about, even if I don't name names. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, maybe this is the problem, is people don't want to go back and talk about these things or be petty about them. And so then, you know, it just keeps happening. But it was a tough workplace. I mean, it was a lot of fun in the sense that the job itself was great. We were making a great magazine, and I worked with, to this day, people who are some of my best friends in this world that I met through that workplace. But it's the kind of place that would be described as toxic. Mm-hmm. And in particular, because of the boss. Mm-hmm. It was a place that we were constantly on your toes. Like, I remember a moment early on, I went home for lunch and was like driving back to the office. And I remember thinking, I have no idea what will happen this afternoon. It was that volatile. Like, it could all explode and you could have the worst afternoon of your life after like a fine morning and a fine lunch, you know? But it was like that kind of on edge feeling every day, especially the first year. So there are a lot of reasons I stayed for 4 years, which we could certainly get into if we want to, which I also think contributes again to this cycle. But I think that 2 years would have given me what I needed in terms of like how working there helped my career.
Right. Did you have a sense of the time that you were supposed to stay to like bring change from within, or were you just a craven careerist?
Yeah, definitely a craven careerist. No, of course I wanted to change it from within. I also felt, you know, I was the editorial director, which meant that I supervised several other people who are all young, some of them first job out of college. I felt very protective. And even when I did leave, I waited until like my whole team left. Mm. And then I was the last one to go. There were also other reasons. I mean, there were financial reasons. There were reasons that felt like, where do I go from here? This was like a dream job at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that aforementioned boss, I think one of the things that he did was made you feel like that was the best you could do and that we were all changing the world together. Like it was like a little bit of, you know, and that just worked for me, especially at that time. And then I think there was like kind of a pendulum swing relationship where it was like really good for a while and then it would like kind of turn toxic again. But then I could always like find reasons that it felt like it was my fault. And I was like, if I could just work harder, do it better, next issue, it'll solve that.
Not to play armchair psychologist. it sounds akin to being in an abusive dating relationship or marriage.
That was certainly the joke that went around the office.
Okay, so the armchair psychologist, like, I don't even have to reach that far. Like, everybody knew this was the dynamic.
I was in therapy at the time for this. So, I mean, it was also just, like, a lot of really young kids out of college that, like,
yeah,
really felt like we'd landed the dream. And it was very hard to leave. But it was very easy to take advantage of, I think, mm-hmm. of all of those people in that particular moment in their career.
Yes. I mean, I worked at Christianity Today magazine, as we've all established, for almost 10 years. And it was my first job out of college. And I didn't experience anything to the degree that you experienced in your previous workplace. But I very much resonate with the sense that this organization, this magazine, is like the epicenter of the most important work you could do.
Right.
That strong sense of mission, and isn't it so rewarding to be a part of the mission of this organization? Mm-hmm. At CT, it was very much like you're part of this legacy.
Yeah.
And it was my first job out of college. And I mean, I know I was grossly underpaid for years.
Oh, yeah.
But also, I think that sense of earnestness and eagerness to make a difference ended up being exploited for the workplace. And then I also didn't have anything to compare the workplace and its leaders
right.
to. So it was really easy to think, I guess this is just how bosses act. I guess this is just how, like, when my colleague barges into my office and kind of yells at me about something I tweeted, I guess this is just how mm-hmm. workplaces are. Like, and it wasn't until leaving and being in a very healthy workplace now that I'm like, oh, those things were not normal. Like those behaviors, those norms, those attitudes were dysfunctional. I don't know if I would say toxic, certainly not to the level of your previous workplace, but dysfunctional and not normal and needed to be corrected. And I just wish I had left like 3 years earlier, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know why I didn't, except that there was security in it and identity yeah. in it. And I knew that other women in the organization kind of liked that I was in decision-making rooms.
Right. Like you felt like you had a sense of responsibility as the first female managing editor.
Yes. Like, if not for me, who will?
I had the same feeling. And I kept thinking I could change it. And I kept thinking I had changed it or it was better or, you know, again, had this feeling of protecting my team. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the time when people would leave, there was like a real rotating door. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the time when people would leave, we'd all get together again because we were all battle buddies. And it was like everybody was kind of really close. We were all good friends in Orlando.
You were like trauma survivors.
Yeah, we were. We totally were. And the employee who had just left a week or two or a month ago or whatever, it was like they'd suddenly were in the light or something, you know, and they would be like, I don't want to talk about this anymore. Mm. And I think they would like suddenly realize that like all of our conversations had always revolved around mm-hmm. work and how bad it was. And suddenly they were like, wait, we could talk about something else. Like, I don't want to get drugged back into that.
Yes.
And then I would be like, oh, you know, you're just moving on. Don't you remember how bad it was? Like, how can you not want to talk about this? And don't you want to like tell the world about it or whatever? And they're like, no, I just want to move on. So what's this episode about?
Trauma bonding, for one. Volatile workplaces, volatile male leaders, and something that I've been calling the evangelical bro code, because the reality is that based on stories that I've been gathering over the last few months, our experiences inside evangelical institutions, you know, churches, nonprofits, colleges and seminaries are not isolated. They are part of a much broader pattern of women being mistreated and marginalized in Christian spaces, especially women in positions of leadership, and especially in places where they are in a minority.
Tell me why it's worse in evangelical circles, or how, maybe in a particular way that it's worse. Like, is this just not the bro code in general? Like, if I went and worked at Google, would it be the same way?
I will answer, but I would like you to pretend to be Michael Barbaro.
Oh, right. It is always great when we cosplay Michael.
Yeah, it's a good question. In some ways, these gender dynamics are certainly not relegated to the evangelical world. I think what makes them unique in a lot of evangelical spaces is that in the corporate world, there are specific anti-discrimination policies. Sometimes there is funding tied to gender parity. There's just a general acceptance that even if there is gender discrimination, like formally, we are a place where women can thrive alongside men, where gender discrimination is not allowed. And in Christian spaces, when you're thinking about a local church or a small nonprofit, these places are not as regulated around discrimination policies. You know, churches have the freedom to hire and fire based on belief. In a lot of the stories that women submitted to me, you know, some of it came down to complementarian beliefs about male headship, male leadership, women being in more support or submissive roles. When a woman tried to exercise leadership in those spaces, there was a real clear, we don't allow that here. We don't believe in that. But also in the evangelical Christian world, there's even in egalitarian spaces, that was something that really stood out to me, that there was mistreatment of women in places that formally would say, we love women, we support women leaders, we believe God has gifted women to exercise their gifts in our institution. I think it's more interpersonal, and it's more because of Christian attitudes about what it means to be a man.
So this came across your radar, and then being the intrepid journalist that you are, you decided to research this, to write about it. So you've done a series of pieces on your Substack, The Beatty Beat, for those of you who don't know.
Not The Beatty Beat, even though I can understand why people would read it that way.
And it is spelled that way.
Exactly.
So you did a series of stories on the evangelical bro code. And you base these on some interviews and submissions, different, like a survey that you did. So tell us a little bit about that series and maybe some top line findings that you brought out of that series.
I didn't realize it was going to be a series, but I started last fall just describing this gender dynamic in Christian workplaces. And I wrote about it in part because I had just spoken with some former colleagues about their own experiences inside the magazine where I used to work. And I felt so discouraged to learn that the problems have persisted. And after I wrote about this, trying to describe this phenomenon, I just got a huge response from women saying, this happened to me too. From that, I thought, you know, it'd be really interesting to actually document some of these stories. Ended up to this day receiving responses from about 170 women.
That's crazy.
Now, 170 is obviously, we cannot extrapolate from 170 individuals to describe all of evangelicalism, but there are, you know, in terms of a qualitative data, there's plenty to tease out there. And so I really just started reading these stories, trying to find some top line commonalities. What are common themes and threads that are emerging? And because I'm an editor and I appreciate alliteration. I went with the three B's.
For the Beatty Beat, also appropriate.
Thank you. So breadwinner bias.
Okay.
Basically, in many Christian organizations, it's just assumed that men are the ones providing for their families and therefore men should be paid more.
Let's come back to that because I feel strongly about that.
I'm shocked.
I mean, I feel strongly about all of these, but I feel like that one has been explored. I feel like that one has been explored less than some of these others.
Mm, yeah, let's do it. The second one will be familiar to you and to a lot of our listeners, the Billy Graham rule. Mm-hmm. This persists. It even persists on Zoom. That was a new one to me.
Yeah, I've heard about this.
Women being asked if they want to meet with a male coworker, they have to bring in a third person to supervise the Zoom meeting.
What if they just have their kid on their lap, you know?
I just think, like, what do you think is going to happen? Have you ever spent time on Zoom? It's not the most erotic forum.
Well, remember, wasn't there that guy that got caught?
Jeffrey Toobin. Okay, all
so,
right.
So, you know.
No, but that was with like a whole group of people. So for some of these people, even having a crowd isn't preventing them from exploring things below.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, breadwinner bias, Billy Graham rule, and then bullying.
Mm, familiar.
Yes, I think we've already touched on it. And also, I was just overwhelmed by how many women described male coworkers coming to their office and screaming at them, like threatening, maybe you don't need to be here anymore.
Yeah.
So very like volatile bullying, but also cold or covert bullying, like spreading rumors about somebody that they're spiritually unfit. Or a lot of women said they got feedback that they were too emotional.
Oh, yeah.
When they would try to raise concerns about how a male colleague was treating them, somebody else would chalk it up to like, you guys just bring out the worst in each other. I was told that at Christianity Today when I tried to raise concerns.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yes, Roxy. Men and women communicate differently, this person had learned in marriage counseling. So that's what was happening between me and my coworker.
Helpful.
Classic. Mm-hmm. Just overt and covert ways that men essentially edged out their female colleagues, and really a sense from a lot of these women that just their presence in the organization was seen as a threat, like trying to do their jobs, trying to exercise agency, use their skills and gifts. There were men around them that did not want them to be there. A lot of women said they were fired without any kind of recourse. Some women talked about being offered non-disclosure agreements. Some women said, you know, I put up with it for 5 years and then I couldn't stand it anymore. Like, I just had to get out. So things are not great. There's something in the water.
That's the bummer about all of this, right? Is that like a lot of women, men too, I mean, go into an evangelical, a Christian workplace thinking that it might be different, that it'll be better, that it'll be edifying and go by the golden rule, or, you know, just like just generally that it would be a more Christian feeling workplace where these shared values would drive how they're treated. And so then to find it even maybe worse than a secular workplace, I think is part of what's just so extremely disheartening for people.
Yeah. I mean, of course, there are pay gaps in the corporate world, but in general, the corporate world recognizes this is a problem. We should be transparent about different levels of pay, and there shouldn't be a gender-based gap.
I mean, all of these problems exist in secular workplaces. I think they're just spiritualized or written off with, like you said, men and women are just different in this way. We were created differently. We communicate differently. So these kinds of Christian beliefs around gender end up being weaponized against women within these workplaces in a way that probably feels really unfair.
Let's come back to the three B's.
Yes.
I received responses from 170 women, and there were just some really poignant and perceptive comments about how the evangelical bro code works.
Mm-hmm.
Here were some of the top line quotes that if I were writing like a cover story about this, I would include. Hypothetically, I know one place I'm not going to pitch the cover story.
All right, let's hear them.
One woman wrote in to say, the bro code is not just toxic narcissists. It's really wonderful, well-meaning men who assume the best of other men. They don't realize how their implicit trust is guiding them to harm the women who have little to no access to them.
Mm-hmm. There is always like a little cadre of men around these leaders often.
For sure, because they recognize that they have to be on that guy's side to get ahead themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, yeah, I know he can be intense, but we just got back from axe throwing night with our bros. And he's actually really great if you get to know him. Or like, he means well, you know?
Yeah. Or like they'll listen and they'll agree with you and say, yeah, it's the worst. That's terrible. But then like you realize that they're not like going to bat for you when they're actually one on one.
Right. They acknowledge that it's bad, but not so much that they would actually do anything to intervene and change the system. Another woman wrote in to say, it's not so much the bro code as the silence around abuse that does the damage. I get that these Christian men leading Christian companies want to avoid a damaging scandal, but what they did was enable an abuser to steal, lie, cheat, and abuse to an even greater degree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've talked about this before, the desire to avoid scandal. Like, there's this problematic behavior, but we don't want it to get out. We don't want other people outside the organization to know about it. So we just are going to minimize and keep it under wraps and certainly never do like an independent investigation, because if people knew what things were like internally, they would stop giving, they would stop subscribing, they would stop supporting us.
Yeah.
Another woman who said she'd worked in SBC institutions for a lot of her life. She said she was threatened because of her quote unquote challenging personality. She says, quote, I've also seen tender and gentle men who respect women and value their work, but it's not just that one bad apple spoils the whole bunch. I think the good apples don't feel that speaking out to root out the bad ones will actually make a real change, because the fruit isn't the problem. It's in the soil these seeds were planted. Which is maybe stretching the agrarian metaphor a little much, but
yeah, maybe. But what is the soil, the bad soil, do you think?
I think she's probably describing evangelicalism as a social and cultural movement.
Right. And just the way that it has a hierarchy of men.
Yeah. How do you begin to upend that hierarchy when it has been in place for generations and then is supported by interpretations of scripture and all this religious tradition and authority? It's a lot to try to dismantle or uproot.
Yeah.
As
and
it were.
I mean, I think as we've talked about in some previous episodes, like about the crisis of masculinity too, within evangelicalism, like the way that that idea about masculinity is so tied to men's identity and sense of like spiritual well-being. Like if they're the man God created them to be, then it includes having the sort of dominion and power and authority over women.
It's almost like the men need help, but it's also not our job. They got to do the work.
It's true. And I think part of what the temptation here is to feel like you can fix it as a woman, or you can like make the difference. Your presence there can make a difference. That it won't happen to you, that you're somehow gonna like be special or fix it or whatever.
Going back to what you shared about your prior workplace, it sounds like your experience really fit in that third category of bullying. Did you feel like you had the language for it at the time?
I think so. I mean, I think we all kind of did. I think there's a way that you don't want to feel like you're the victim of bullying. Like, that feels weak in a way. And so maybe it was hard to admit that in some ways, that sense of powerlessness, or the sense that somebody has that much power over you.
It just underscores that beneath the facade of visionary leadership for so many of these leaders is incompetence.
Yeah. And a lot of people doing the work for them.
Yes. Men who get platformed as visionary or entrepreneurial, like the person with all the great ideas, or do have great ideas, but don't have the first clue about how to actually execute them. And other people are hired to essentially execute their master plan. And I also want to say emotional intelligence and interpersonal intelligence should be part of what we consider competence. Like at CT, there was this attitude that if you knew how to write well and edit well and had this vast knowledge of evangelical history, you were uber competent, even if you treated your colleagues like crap. Like, that didn't matter.
Right. Well, your leadership skills, those were just assumed.
It was your intellectual skills or knowledge base. And I want to say, no, someone who storms into your office to yell at you or demeans you in a meeting or accuses you of being overly emotional, that's an incompetent person. Like, that's an incompetent colleague. It feels very toxically masculine to kind of set aside interpersonal competence as irrelevant.
There's been lots written about Steve Jobs, not an evangelical, but this whole like, oh, the visionary leader who is so brilliant, and his like madness and bullying and whatever is all part of the genius, right?
Yes.
There's something about evangelicalism, I think, that sort of feeds that same narrative. And part of it, I think, is this way that evangelicalism is so deliberately outside of an institutional hierarchy, or like in a lot of other Christian institutions, like you have to go through like a lot to become a leader.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying those systems are perfect, but within evangelicalism, you can become a pastor at like 21 or 22. You can go plant a church. You can just like leapfrog over a lot of potentially important formational aspects of becoming a leader that's like slow work. And so I do think there are a lot of very young, very ambitious
dudes.
Yeah, dudes with like some hubris that are just like, I'm going to plant a church.
Roxy, God called them to.
Right.
God, you know, told them.
Or start a magazine, you know, and like never really had authority over them. And I think, you know, like I think of Mark Driscoll, like I think there's a lot of that where men become leaders too young in evangelicalism based on charisma or something. Sometimes they have money.
Or, I mean, truly, I'm thinking of Matt Chandler, and to my knowledge, he has not been accused of bullying behavior at the Village Church, but he is somebody who never went to seminary, planted the Village Church. I mean, he couldn't have been older than 25, has been incredibly successful at building this church network. But sometimes in things that he has said, it's almost as if he's proud of the fact that he could just skip seminary because the call upon his life was just that strong. And I'm not questioning the idea that God calls certain people to ministry.
Right.
But I do think it is unhealthy to ignore or downplay credentialing and like slow formation. Like, what if we decided people don't become pastors until they're age 40?
Right.
I don't know how to like enforce this. But what if we just had this sense of, we value people who have lived enough life to have gleaned some wisdom.
And, you know, being a good preacher does not make you a good supervisor or a good leader of a church. It just makes you a good preacher.
Yeah. This reminds me of one of the stories that I drew out at the Beatty Beat a couple weeks ago with a woman who used to work at the Church of Dane Ortland, who is a prominent author has this best-selling book, Gentle and Lowly, which, as it turns out, is somewhat of an ironic title.
Yeah.
She had worked at this church, Naperville Presbyterian, for several years. And as she tells it, Dane was selected to become, well, he was serving on the search committee that selected himself to be the pastor.
Uh-huh.
And as part of the discernment, the search committee dropped the requirement that a candidate have pastoral experience or seminary education. So somehow this person was able to leapfrog over the requirements to have pastoral experience. Ends up that, at least according to Emily Hyland, the woman who worked at the church and was eventually fired without recourse by Dane, she says he's unqualified to spiritually lead people. He's not a safe spiritual leader.
See, I think that's a good point. It's not just that pastors are supposed to be good leaders in like an institutional sense or like go read a good leadership book. They're also supposed to care for your soul. They're supposed to be someone who leads you through very difficult times. Like there's a whole pastoral element that, again, doesn't come with being a good preacher. Like that's something that I do think needs a level of gravitas and sobriety going into that. And it needs to be taught. You should go to seminary for that, if nothing else. And you should maybe be mentored, serve under another pastor, like watch how that happens. You know, I think there's, again, that's not the public facing thing that everybody celebrates and sees, but pastoral leadership, being someone's pastor.
Yes.
That's part of the job and it's really important.
Yes. Being a best-selling author by no means qualifies you to shepherd people's souls. We will get into the significance of that. But before we do that, let's give a shout out to the organization that makes this all possible.
Religion News Service is an independent, award-winning source of global reporting on religion, spirituality, culture, and ethics.
Whether you celebrate Easter or the vernal equinox or simply eat a lot of chocolate bunnies, RNS has you covered.
Our listeners should know that Saved by the City, we have some podcast company these days. Religion News Service now has a podcast network. It includes Martini Judaism with Rabbi Jeffrey Salkin and The State of Belief with Reverend Paul Rauschenbusch. We'd also love to hear your feedback and ideas for future guests and topics. Let us know by emailing us at sbtcpodcast@religionnews.com.
Hey there, curious minds.
Get ready to embark on a unique journey at the crossroads of money and religion with our new podcast, Money Meet Meaning.
The seductive effect of money, we think it can do the work that God does because there's something about money that does that. It's wild.
I'm Amber Hacker.
And I'm Tom Levinson.
Tune in for a blend of wisdom and levity as we decode the path to a more meaningful relationship with money.
I think giving, and this is a little crass, but I feel like it's the ultimate middle finger to money. It's liberating to give some away.
This podcast is your gateway to a vibrant and thought-provoking exploration of the interconnectedness of wealth and spirituality.
Join us as we unravel the surprising influence of ancient wisdom on modern finances.
Faith pervades people's lives and our society. And because money is such an important part of people's lives, exploring that intersection of faith and money, I think, is super, super interesting.
Get ready to be informed, entertained, and inspired to transform your financial outlook with Money Meet Meaning. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, I do want to go back to the breadwinner thing. This is not something I know for sure that I've experienced because, of course, you know, it was all very hush-hush what people made at all the Christian places I've worked. But I feel like I see it a lot in churches where, you know, the pastor makes a certain amount and there's like a consideration of his family. And that's kind of maybe also true for the worship leader or for other men on staff.
Mm-hmm.
There's an assumption that a lot of the women that work at churches have husbands who make mm-hmm. the money to support them, and that the job at church is practically a volunteer role.
Yes.
And it's often not full time. It doesn't include benefits. And it's because those roles used to be volunteer roles by women, a lot of them, because, you know, there was a time when most women stayed at home and they volunteered at church or volunteered at the senior center, or there's a lot of work that used to be done by women as volunteers that, you know, I think is still really underpaid. And so I think that a lot of churches have operated for a very long time on a budget that included the work of volunteer women. Mm-hmm. And that's, that ethos is still very much there.
Yes. I would say definitely based on the stories that I heard from women who had spent any time working in churches, their work was often, in terms of hours spent, more than some of the formally paid men working on staff. And a lot of behind the scenes work, a lot of unsexy, boring, but absolutely dire work that is needed to keep a church's doors open.
Yeah.
But then the woman would ask about a raise or find out what some of her colleagues, her male colleagues, were making. And there would just be this astronomical gap, or a sense of, I mean, one woman told me she'd been volunteering 20 to 30 hours a week for her church. And it was getting to be so much time that she was in conversation with the church leaders about creating a part-time, formally paid position. And one of the leaders said, oh, we thought you were happy to do this work without pay because your husband makes good money.
Yep. There it is.
Another woman became like director of operations. It was a full-time paid job. She had access to all the budget numbers, and so she could see what everybody made. She was making like $30,000 a year, learned that her predecessor, who was a man and only working 10 hours a week, was making $60,000.
What?
10 hours a week.
What?
When you start to learn even just a little bit about the finances, you realize both how much work women are doing to keep the churches running and how little they're actually being paid because of this sense that you're happy to give and serve with your time and energy. But when the men serve, we need to formally pay them well because they have families to support.
Yep. I mean, this is like, again, I think born out of a time when that was the model that women volunteered. But now, I mean, it's a different time. Nobody's getting paid as much, at least not, you know, compared to what things cost. So like one person's salary can rarely support a whole family. So a lot of women are needing to work. And obviously also a lot of women want to work. And I know a lot of single women who work for churches that are like, I don't have a husband to support me. Like, I need to be paid well for the work that I'm doing so that I can support myself. And I think that the model of how church works, the financial model of how church has worked for so long, just like isn't built for society now.
So I'm coming to the end of this Evangelical Bro Code series. Truthfully, it's like too depressing. I want to write and think about other things.
Yeah.
And I've really wanted to end the series with some kind of solution or vision of a way forward. How do we crack the Evangelical Bro Code? How do we make sure women are flourishing in these Christian organizations? And I have totally come up short. Like, I do not have a sense of how we fix this.
Well, like, does that mean like women don't go work in evangelical spaces?
I'm super reticent to tell women, as in a categorical way, avoid working in evangelical organizations, because I know what it's like to feel like God is calling you to a specific place, and I don't want to squash that in somebody else. And at the same time, I would strongly caution women considering entering into these spaces, especially younger women who, like me, might not be able to see abusive or unhealthy or toxic dynamics until they realize, oh, I've invested 10 years of my career in this space that doesn't value me like it should and basically chewed me up and spit me out.
I think when I reflect on my career in evangelical spaces, I have had some better experiences and some worse experiences. I think there has been some universal threads, some things that I would be like, that's a yellow flag always, if not a red flag, which is like the use of the word, we're all family here.
Oh, yeah. We should do a whole episode about that.
We really should. And the other thing, like, it's not one of your B's, but I would have said one of the other big things is like of intimacy that I think a lot of evangelical men, like an emotional intimacy that they try to curate with their coworkers that I think can be really complicated, but that can be another episode. Some of the things that I think to look for if you are going to work in an evangelical space would be a bigger institution that's either been around for a while or has some real regulations in place. I think my two best evangelical workplace experiences were actually at for-profit organizations. Mm-hmm. There was a lot more regulation around it that was just like, this is state law, you know? I think I would caution against like the sort of founder-led situation, but I don't know that that's totally fair because they'll rule out a lot of places, but...
I remember something you said in our previous episode about the Christianity Today report after it had come out and we were reflecting on our experiences there. And you saying, you know, I used to feel kind of proud for being the only woman in the room or one of the only women in the room. And now I see that as a danger. This is a red flag if I'm the only woman in the room.
That was so smart of me to say that. I was so smart back then.
It was very smart and perceptive. I think that is absolutely right. I think a lot of the women who have been negatively impacted by the evangelical bro code are trying to forge a place in these very male-dominated spaces and are often the only woman in the room or one of the only women in the room. Yeah. And I think I just want to say, you don't have to stay to be a trailblazer. Like, you do not have to shoulder and put up with the crap. Part of me just wants to say, like, men have their work cut out for them. It's not our work. It's their work. Good boundaries.
I think that's right. I mean, I think a lot of women feel like they need to stay for all kinds of reasons. And we both began this episode saying, I wish we'd left sooner. And so I do think that's like a worthwhile takeaway, women, is that if you are in this kind of a space, like you can find something else.
Yes. Several women in recounting their stories said, I work in an entirely non-Christian mainstream workplace. And I have never felt more respected and valued by my colleagues.
Yeah.
Like, yes, be in places that are delighted to have you, that like give you the honor and respect that you deserve as a talented person.
Yeah, it's a bummer that like the secular world out there has figured out how to honor women, even if it's because they're legally have to. But it's like at least the boundaries have been put in place and like recognized as important.
One writer who I really appreciate, Lori Ferguson Wilbert, left this comment in response to the Evangelical Bro Code series. And I thought it really hit at what we're talking about. She says, only when we find our whole goodness and value in Jesus, who in his own words gives us permission to shake the dust off our feet and stop throwing pearls before swine, will we actually see true change in these environments. Leaving is sometimes the best thing we can do. Leaving is the most careful thing we can do. Care for our own souls and selves and care for those God actually has entrusted us to lead and love. No more pearls before swine, ladies.
Clutch those pearls. Different metaphor, but...
to your bosom.
Saved by the City is a Religion News Service production. The producer is Jay Woodward and the consulting editor is Paul O'Donnell. We get production assistance from Julia Windham.
Chaz Russo put together our look and Martin Fowler wrote our theme music.
We are Roxy Stone
and Caitlin Beatty.
Thanks for listening.